reservation. That is, made it smaller, made it no longer part of the reservation, taken it out of Indian jurisdiction. The Supreme Court fortunately decided that the reservation had not been diminished because it was not Congress's intent to do so. Congress had not meant to make that reservation smaller, and so Indian jurisdiction still existed in that part of the reservation, the Supreme Court decided. But there's a footnote in that decision that is really very chilling. And the footnote says that Congress most certainly could do that if it wanted to. That the case of Lone Wolf versus Hitchcock makes it clear that if Congress chooses to abrogate a treaty, if Congress chooses to do away with Indian jurisdiction over a particular area of land, or even over all land, Congress can do so without Indian consent. Now, this is a decision came down, 2 weeks ago, that saying that Congress enjoys essentially unfettered power to unilaterally do away with Indian jurisdiction over land set aside in a treaty as a reservation. And that doctrine, this idea that Congress can change treaties, that Congress can unilaterally, at its whim, invade Indian rights, do away with them completely, is devastating. It's in Martinez as well. For no reason that I could see, Justice Marshall, writing in Martinez, went out of his way. It wasn't even relevant in the case, but he went out of his way in there to say Congress could, of course, terminate these Indian governments if they want to and do away with them altogether. Just like that. That's the Supreme Court just a few years ago in Martinez. They seem to be very fond of reaffirming this limitless power to just do away with Indian rights. And so you see, you can get decisions like the Bolt decision that are decisions to enforce a treaty that is recognized and acknowledged by the United States government. But if the United States government chooses to change that, end it, do away with it, there are very few limits on that power. There's very little that can be done to stop that. Under the existing law, under the Lone Wolf Doctrine, Congress can even abrogate a treaty at will, without compensation, without restriction. Everybody is trying to put an end to that. I mean, we're trying to make it so that that can't happen. We're trying to make little inroads so that there will be some limits on what Congress can do. And there have been little gains made in Delaware versus Weeks. The Supreme Court said, well, we will take a look at acts of Congress and we'll consider whether or not it's within Congress power. But all they said was, we're going to look and see if this is consistent with Congress's unique obligation to Indians. What's that? Believe me, I don't care to have my rights hanging on that kind of a thread, where we're talking about the existence of Indian governments, the right of the Yakama Nation to exist, the rights like the fishing rights, land rights, governmental rights of all sorts. Much longer answer than you probably had in mind, but such a good point.
I appreciate this, and I think one of the points being is that the judicial system seems to be acting in a legislative manner, and as far as human rights go, that is morally wrong. If I may, at this point, refer back to the plenary power of Congress and the term competency. It is a vicious cycle that we are into when they determine that I am incompetent and so therefore can remain a ward of the government. But as soon as I become competent, then I should have my land put into fee simple and assimilate into the mainstream of society and become a taxpayer. Every 5 years, the superintendent of a tribe must ask the Secretary of the Interior to renew a treaty, continue on with a treaty of a tribe. And just this last year, Secretary of the Interior approved that the Yakimas can remain a treaty tribe and remain a recognized tribe for another 5 years, which is scary. But the instance I can use on the Yakima was an individual inherited 40 acres from some relatives. He was an enrolled Yakima. The land at one time or another was put into fee simple, but then returned back to trust with the purchase of it by him, and the IRS came and said, now you must be taxed. And also, this land was not meant initially for cattle raising, but you are putting cattle on there now, and so we can tax the land and the cattle. We had to go to court and declare that he was incompetent. He was an incompetent person and a ward of the, and therefore a ward of the government, and so the IRS had to back away eventually, just to make the story short. Now, this vicious cycle that we are into, as long as I'm incompetent, but this term that they have, incompetency, ward of the government, can be utilized with along with the plenary power of Congress every 5 years. They can turn you loose, as you say, extinguish your rights.
Well, what you really mean is that you must continue to insist that you're incompetent.
Yes.
Because your only choice is that otherwise they're going to come and tax your land.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, they're going to turn loose the state on you. The jurisdiction will change, and so on. I mean, it's a terrible choice.
And you speak.
That's what I mean. That trusteeship is substituted
right.
for real rights. Why isn't it understood that you and other Indian nations and people have a right to be free from taxation, particularly where you have treaty agreements?
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't it understood that you have a right to govern your affairs without state and federal interference? I mean, those would be real rights. They appear to be rights in the treaties, but yet you have to buy into this whole insane trusteeship and go around declaring yourself to be incompetent as though you were a lunatic in order to protect what should be real enforceable rights. And the same thing starting up here now. You get the same business. I mean, how on earth did the United States ever get any right to do anything with native land up here? Did they get it from the Russians? Heck no. And the Russians didn't have it. The old doctrine of international law is in Latin, nemo dat quod non habet. And the only reason for giving you that is to show how old it is. It means nobody can give what they don't have. The Russians didn't have any right or title to this land, and so they couldn't give any of it to the United States. In fact, they didn't even pretend to. The United States just arrogantly claimed to have it. It was a simple assumption of a right that didn't exist, of a power that didn't exist.
They were supposed to have bought it back from the Russians for $7.2 million.
Well, at most, the United States got whatever Russia had, okay? Right?
Mm-hmm.
At most, maybe they didn't even have that. I'm not sure I'm willing to concede that, but at most, the United States acquired only what Russia had. And to then assume that somehow the United States owns the underlying title to land that they've never lived on. They never conquered anybody. They didn't discover it. They didn't buy it. Nobody ever gave it to them, sold it to them, or anything of the sort, is outlandish. And the only reason that exists is because of what I was describing, this lawlessness, this legal vacuum, where people have forgotten that originally international law was to govern those relations. once international law was out of the picture, the United States did as it wished, and is not legal. I mean, there's no reason to buy into this. Well, I think it's only fair to call it lawlessness. You buy into a essentially lawless system.
Perhaps the assumption comes from the assistance given by the Russians back when the United States was fighting the British. And then I guess there was a right of way for a telegraph line or something here that the Russians had. So.
Mm.
Thank you for your answer.
Thank you.
That's great.
Tim, just before you carry on, did you want to ask something, Kim Gottschalk?
Yes, I would like to address a question to Mr. Coulter. But first of all, I'd just like to, for a point of clarification, the recent case that came down that he was talking about is Solemn versus Bartlett, and not Walton, the Supreme Court case. You made the comment that no useful resolution is going to come about of the problems under ANCSA unless the proper legal circumstances exist, and that will not happen as long as it is conceded that Congress basically has plenary power. I appreciate the comments you're making, and I think they're very interesting and stimulating. Nevertheless, as an attorney, I find that you must deal with the real world. The real world is that there's a deadline of 1991. I think if there's any safe assumption, it is that there is not going to be a whole-scale change in the view, the legal view of Congress power over Indian affairs by 1991. Where does that leave the people who are under ANCSA? You're saying there just isn't going to be a resolution until that is changed. I'm saying that, in my opinion, the underlying legal rationale is not going to change by 1991. There will not be a decision from the Supreme Court by 1991 that Congress no longer has plenary power and cannot do what it has done for the history of this country. Given that reality, what is your suggestion for a resolution? And I might also point out, I know you're displeased with the trustee relationship. I think it's a mixed bag, there's no doubt about that. There are definitely some bad points about it. However, as I see it, it has been used historically as a vehicle for precisely many of the problems that are presently faced by the Alaskan Natives under ANCSA, namely protection from state taxation, for protection from alienation of their lands. So if what you're going to do is throw out all the legal doctrines of the past that have accomplished the good purposes as well as brought the bad along with it, what do you propose to take its place, and how is this going to be put in place in time to stave off whatever is potentially going to happen in 1991?
Well, first of all, I don't accept your idea of reality. You're just asking me to cave in and accept what Congress has done, and the very thing I'm saying is that I don't accept it. I don't accept it in regard to the clients that I have. I don't think Alaska Natives are going to accept it. That's the kind of practicality that I think has led us to where we are.
You're misinterpreting my question. My question is not that you might not have a totally legitimate point that all this should be fought, the idea of plenary power, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not contesting that in the least. I'm saying I'm making a prediction based on my past experience that in the next 7 years that will not come about. Okay, I think it's something that maybe should be argued for, and maybe in the long run will succeed. That remains to be seen. I think the people here are faced with a practical deadline. That is the point of practicality I'm not talking about, not the practicality of ultimately putting the whole idea of Indian relations with the federal government on a sounder basis. I put that to one side.
Well, I don't think you have to solve all of these legal problems in order to get anywhere. I didn't say that. What I'm trying to suggest is not that this whole body of law has to be changed by 1991. What I am suggesting is that an ultimate resolution is not likely to occur until that is done. Between now and 1991, people should do what they can. But I'm trying to suggest, I think that it's foolish to try to do something practical, to use your words, without doing something to get at the underlying problem. If we're practical between now and 1991 and do not look at the underlying problem, there won't be anything useful accomplished. The next generation, you know, the children of these people here are going to be doing the same thing over again, and we'll have an ongoing claim. You've got to come, I think people have got to get at the underlying problem. The underlying problem is not that bill, it's not that act, it's not ANCSA. The underlying problem is the so-called or is the supposedly legal relationship between the United States and Native peoples. That's what needs to be changed. And if it takes until the year 2000 or the year 3000, I don't care. I think it has to be changed. It probably will be changed. And I'm not near as pessimistic as you. It's been tremendous progress in changing these doctrines just in the past couple of years.
Okay, well, if you're saying it might come about in the year 3000, I would characterize that as modestly pessimistic. So maybe to avoid any
I'm just saying it doesn't matter how long it takes. Okay. If it's the right thing to do, then that's what I would suggest working towards.
I certainly agree that you work towards whatever is the right thing to do, no matter how long it takes. I disagree with the proposition that things don't become more difficult as circumstances change. If nothing is done by 1991, and if stocks become alienable and 76% of native stock is held by non-Indians 5 years after that point, you've created a situation which makes an ultimate resolution even more difficult. So I guess maybe the best way to put my question to you is, let's agree with you that you work for the long-term situation, whether it comes about, as you said, by the year 2000 or the year 3000. My question to you is, given the fact that you don't like the underlying assumptions, nevertheless, what do you specifically do to meet the specific problems of ANCSA by 1991?
Yeah, I mean, let's be very clear. I never said don't do anything. I mean, those are only your words. I mean, this idea that you have to either accept my views and change everything or don't do anything by 1991, you must not have been listening.
No, I didn't say that. I didn't say that you said don't do anything. I said, what are you suggesting? What do you want to do?
I just wanted to be clear that you're not putting words in my mouth.
Excuse me, Tim. I think that that question has now been stated sufficiently.
Yes.
And if you want to deal with it in the course of your presentation,
yes,
I think we'll leave that to you. Just before you go on, Tim, might I just ask Ralph Johnson to pick up a loose end here? Russell Jim asked about the footnotes in the Supreme Court's decision in the Bolt case, and did they suggest that it was possible, using congressional plenary power, to nullify the Bolt case?
Yes, that's true. That is in a footnote. It's simply another expression of what Tim Colder is talking about concerning the plenary power of Congress. I'd like to come back to a couple of practical factors, though, that are involved in the Bolt decision, which make it extremely unlikely that such an action would occur in the real world. And that is that, one, by the judicial decision providing the Indians with one-half, 50% of the harvestable catch of salmon in the Washington waters, the courts put a quantity to the amount of fish that the Indians were entitled to. So if Congress tried to take away that treaty right, they now have to deal with a dollar quantity, with a value which economists can determine what that's worth. That's terribly expensive. And Congress probably, in any political sense, is not going to do that, because that would only benefit a few 4,000 or 5,000 commercial fishermen in the state of Washington primarily, and some sportsmen. It would not benefit the United States generally. So that politically, it is not a very attractive thing for Congress to do, to appropriate hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to buy out the Indians' fishing right. Before the Bolt decision, they could have done so probably without paying the Indians at least very much, because the Indians' right had not been quantified. The other aspect of it is that while the Indian fishing rights controversy preoccupies the commercial and sports fishermen, more the sports, the steelheaders in the state of Washington than it should. It is a local question, and Congress has indicated many times it's not really very interested in the fishing interests of the steelheaders of the state of Washington. Our local congresspeople are very concerned about that, but Congress is concerned about a lot of other things. And so I suspect that in the real political world that Congress will not exercise its plenary power. I'm not being optimistic about it. I think that's being quite realistic, that they will not exercise their plenary power to change the result of the Bolt decision.
Tim, before you carry on, I might say that as you've been talking, I've written down a number of questions, and I think David Case and Ralph Johnson and others have done so, and we'll return to those later. I think you're provoking...
Kim's question was a good one.
It was.
And
a good one.
And if voices are raised, it's only with enthusiasm and with no lack of respect. His question is so good that I did just want to make clear what exactly we were talking about. The question of what to do between now and 1991 is really not mine to answer, so I don't want to be too presumptive, but there were some suggestions that I would make, suggestions like this. I didn't really mean to go this far, but since I'm asked, one approach would be to not attack the existing, this is not my suggestion, this is the alternative I reject. One alternative would be to simply sidestep, disregard, don't worry about these basic legal problems, and just go back to Congress and try to get some amendments passed. Go back to Congress with hat in hand and say, we didn't get a good enough deal. We wish that Congress, in its sovereign benevolence, would do something nicer for us than what it just did. It seems to me that that's not likely to be very good in the long run, because the next generation, and it might even be the same generation 1 or 2 years later, is going to say that wasn't right either, because we never had the chance, we never had the opportunity to assert and get for our own native people what properly belonged to us. And they're going to say we were denied our basic fundamental underlying rights. We were only permitted to go to Congress and ask for another handout, and that will never be seen as just. I think instead a more viable alternative is to establish what does indeed rightfully, justly, morally belong to Alaskan Native peoples, and insist upon that as a matter of right, not simply as something that Congress in its whim or Congress in its sovereign graciousness will grant to Native peoples. You have to do what you can between now and 1991 to avoid bad consequences of the law as it now stands, but I think a strategy of going to Congress and whining for a better handout is not likely to result in the better kind of resolution. Better, I think, to come to grips with the underlying problem and try to demand a change in the basic legal relationship. Not to say there shouldn't be interim accommodations, do something between now and 1991 to stave off the worst consequences, but don't, in the course of doing that, buy into the continuation of what is fundamentally a lawless and unfair and unjust system. I think to go beyond that is a little silly. I'm not an expert on ANCSA. I'm certainly not an Alaskan native, and that's what the people here need to decide, exactly what they want to do, and not for me, really. Did I get at what you were asking about?
Carry on from where you were when Russell Jim asked his question.
Well, I was really very close. I mean, the questions, as usual, the questions were right on point and have pretty well brought out the other things that I had meant to say, but I can't help but conclude by making a few more remarks. The observation that has occurred to me, and Ada Deer has reminded me of it, the Black Hills case reminds me of it, and that is this, that ultimately the law does not define and determine what native rights are. It seems in the long run just the other way around. I mean, if Ada Deer had ever believed that the law defined and limited what the right of the Menominee people was, there would never have been a Restoration Act. Quite the contrary, it was the just, moral, ethical claim of the Menominee people, which came from the people, up from the bottom, and the law changed. And I have been tremendously excited by this commission and by the whole, well, movement of Alaska Native people to review ANCSA, because it seems to be just exactly that sort of thing coming from the village level up. It is of immense proportions, and the prospect that Native people can, by asserting their proper, just, moral, natural rights, that I think the Alaska Native people can change the law. You will define what the law is. You will eventually define what your rights are, and you will define what the law is, and not the other way around. And so Alaska Native people are going to find themselves, I think, in a leadership position in changing the law that affects Indian people, Native people in the lower 48, and in fact throughout the Americas. This same problem, as has been mentioned, exists in Mexico, Guatemala, Nicaragua, everywhere, right on down the way. And the UN Working Group on Indigenous Populations is going to be considering this very subject this summer in August. They've set aside their annual session this August to look at land rights. And of course, the key issue is, do these dominant governments, do the colonizing settler regimes, if you will, actually have the right to take and dispose of and govern indigenous peoples' land rights where there's been no free cession, no consented arrangement? That's the issue. It's an international, in fact, worldwide issue. And I see nothing as exciting as this development here that's going to make that issue a real one and that stands or that shows real prospect for making some fantastic progress on these things. So I'm very excited, very pleased to see all of this, and truthfully, very optimistic.
I wonder, just before, might I... chairman, take advantage of that position to ask a question that perhaps Joe and Joe Jorgensen and others might like to comment on. In Canada, we study the U.S. history and the U.S. Constitution, and of course, our notions of native rights in Canada, as they are discussed in the courts, are to a great extent derived from the theses propounded by Chief Justice John Marshall and Johnson and McIntosh and Worcester versus Georgia and so on. But Tim said something that I thought was that hadn't occurred to me. He said that in the U.S. Constitution, you set out the position of the federal government, the relation of the citizens of the U.S. to the federal government. You set out the position of the governments of the states. You set out the position of citizens in relation to the state governments. But you did not include the native governments in the Constitution. No reference is made to them. There is simply a disposition of jurisdiction over Indians in the Commerce Clause. Nothing further was said, and Tim left a clear implication that that was an historic and omission whose implications are still with us. I think he indicated that Native governments have preceded any others, and certainly along with the governments of the states and of the even the tenuous federal arrangements that you had under the Articles of Confederation. You only had a federal government, if such it was, that pre-existed the Constitution by 8 or 9 years, whatever it was. I just wondered if you, Ralph Johnson, or David Case, or any of the others had any observations to make on that. David Case?
Well, I think that's essentially true, and that's one of the things about Tim's remarks that I identified with intellectually. I think that the United States Constitution basically ignores the status of Native American people within the context of U.S. federalism, and it sets up this this one. It's hard to believe that a clause of a few words can completely define the relationships of any two peoples to each other. But what has, I think, happened is that the U.S. Supreme Court has really taken that clause and defined out a relationship that is plagued by all of the disadvantages that Tim has and others have laid out here. I guess my question, and I don't mean to change your question, but is to Tim and others who've had some experience with it. What specifically, I mean, what sort of, without revealing any tactical secrets, what kinds of approaches do you envision as being viable to change that situation, the law, the rights of Native American people?
Oh, there are a lot of things. You see, in the Seminole case a few years ago, I was representing one of the Seminole entities that had fought to stop this fraudulent claim in the Indian Claims Commission, and we sued the Indian Claims Commission, saying that the Claims Commission was in violation of the Claims Commission Act and the United States Constitution because they were adjudicating title to my client's land, I mean, the actual homes that they were living in, without due process, notice, opportunity to be heard, or anything. My clients were thrown out of court by a 3-judge federal court that said, I'm sorry, but you Seminoles are Indians, and if the United States government wants to confiscate your property without due process, notice, opportunity to be heard, or anything, they can jolly well do it. Case dismissed, all the way to the Supreme Court. I tried to argue that, I thought the Fifth Amendment applied to everybody. And I argued that the Tihatan decision did not, in fact, establish that Congress could take Indian land. I mean, there was only timber involved in the Tihatan case. Made lots of arguments that, after all, Indian people should have at least the same constitutional rights that other people do, should have other rights as well, but at least the same basic rights as others. And at that time, and that was about 1979, there was not one single law review article, and I mean not one, not even a law review article that said that that was so or ought to be so. There wasn't any judge's decision anywhere that said that Indian property ought to be protected against theft by United States action. There wasn't even a learned speech anywhere that suggested that. We were standing up there in front of the judge in fact, three judges in the D.C. Circuit, and they were saying, well, you know, Tiaton says this, what, why do you think you're right? And, well, we're just right, Your Honor. I couldn't point to anybody that agreed with us. And that was horrible. And we backed off and said, well, we're going to lay a foundation. We're going to get those law review articles written. We're going to get people who will stand up with us, people who will file friend of the court briefs. We're going to get churches. We're going to get the bar associations. We're going to get the community. We're going to get everybody moving along with us. We're going to start talking to Congress. Maybe we can get a joint resolution out of Congress. Maybe we can even get a committee report that suggests that possibly Congress can't steal Indian land. You know, it seems so outrageous, but at that time, and this was just a few years ago, there was absolutely nothing. A U.S. Congressional Reference Service report absolutely concluded in a technical study done for the Senate Select Committee that Congress did have the absolute right to take Indian land without compensation. We wanted to change that report, so next time they write that thing, it'll come out the other way and say, well, maybe there's a constitutional problem. And it's working. We now have, there's six or eight good law review articles now that come out on our side in just this short space of years. There are resolutions by the major Indian organizations that take the clear position. Now, that's self-serving, I grant you, but a few years ago, even that didn't exist. The lawyers were all telling the Indian people that the trust responsibility was the only thing they had to worry about, and just trust in the federal government. Don't worry about any legal rights. Well, now that's beginning to change. And if we have to go back to court again, and which I don't recommend, because I think Kim is right, the courts don't change overnight, especially this Supreme Court. I don't expect them to rule in our favor anytime soon. In fact, I would do everything I could to keep these cases out of court for the time being. But in the meantime, we're developing a body of thought, a body of learned legal scholarship that is going to support a better understanding next time. And we did. We got a decision out of the Second Circuit. In fact, the Native American Rights Fund was on the case in the Oneida decision. That judge, the judge that wrote the decision, wrote a whole different theory of Indian land title than what's been coming down lately. He reverted back to the John Marshall approach. He decided that discovery did not give the United States title, only gave the United States the right to acquire the land from the Indians if they could. And the decision cited a law review article written by one of my staff lawyers. These little things begin to add up. It was, by the way, he had written it before he was on my staff. It wasn't, it was not a setup. And he was not involved in that case either. So it was just what it was supposed to be. It was a scholarly article the court relied on and came out with a good decision. And little by little, this stuff is going to add up. And it begins to add up faster than you think. The Tiaton Doctrine only came down in 1955. It didn't really exist before that. The Supreme Court made it up. So this is what we need. Now suppose this commission concluded that those legal doctrines were wrong and included that in its report. That would be another blow against the empire. And so it will be. Everybody everywhere has to work against these things, and we'll win. I think that's how. There will be no great slaying of the dragon. I don't expect to see anybody arguing that decision in the Supreme Court. I think it'll probably wither away, rot away, before the Supreme Court ever decides to overthrow it. A few years ago, again, we all worked together, Native American Rights Fund, lots of other lawyers too, to beat that Eastern Indian land claim settlement bill, which would have extinguished Indian land claims, again, without due process, fair market compensation. For the first time, we all came out and said that would be unconstitutional, shouldn't do that. And we won. That died in the committee. And Barry Goldwater and Senator Cohen from Maine were up there saying, I think there are serious constitutional problems about this. And just 2 years before, they were all gung-ho exactly the other way, saying there was no constitutional problem with doing that. So that's how I think it'll happen. And
just could I utter a thought, because I think that we're going to be discussing what Tim has said for some time, and when we come to Ralph Lerner, which may not be for some time, perhaps I could ask him to reflect on something that occurred to me while Tim was speaking. That is that in North America, this is so in Canada as well as the United States, I think it's so in Western Europe, a philosophy known as conservatism, I'm not altogether certain that that's what it is, but it's certainly widely discussed in academic journals and is said to prevail in the councils of the president and others. And one of its tenets, as I understand it, and this may be really philosophical small-l liberalism from another century, but one of its tenets is that the powers of government should be limited. And Mr. Lerner might, perhaps when we reach him, be able to indicate whether or not that affords a philosophical foundation, among others, for what Tim has been telling us this morning when he has urged that the illegitimacy of the foundations for the claim by Congress that it has the power to take Indian land without compensation. I should think that from the point of view of philosophical conservatism, that would be a primary limitation on the powers of any government. That is, it should not have the power to take a citizen's property or the property of distinct people within the state. It should not have the property power to take their property without compensation. David, you had a question, and then Joe Jorgensen, because I'd cut Joe off earlier.
Well, briefly, we've heard in other forums, actually, discussions of the utility of international forums for as mechanisms to pursue these kinds of changes. And in Canada, there has been recently a constitutional reform of some sort that remains to be seen how effective that is. Can you comment on the likelihood, availability of international or constitutional reforms with respect to changing the kinds of legal doctrines you mentioned?
Well, I think it can be useful. You take the, by comparison, the effort to overcome the doctrine of legal racial segregation, the doctrine that it was all right to have segregated schools and segregated public facilities. Well, when blacks set out on their long, long legal struggle to get rid of the separate but equal doctrine, one of the things they did was go to the United Nations with a petition saying that the racial segregation that existed in the United States was a violation of their fundamental human rights, which it most certainly was. And, you know, that was not some group of crazies. That was the NAACP that went to the UN with that human rights petition. And it was just part, and you have to understand, it was just part of an overall effort to change an unjust legal doctrine. It gets public attention, it gets world attention, it causes government officials and citizens of other countries to focus their attention on the United States. They write letters, they ask questions, they chat about it over cocktails with the U.S. ambassador. The U.S. ambassador writes back and says, how am I going to answer these people? And the correspondence is available under the Freedom of Information Act. The State Department then has to compose replies, and they have to ask the Interior Department, do we take Indian land without due process? Of course, the answer is yes, and they have to come up with some explanation for that. The overall process is very healthy because the State Department, for one thing, is a lot smarter than the Interior Department, and they have a whole lot more pride. They hate to have to answer that this is true. We did manage to get the U.S. government's response to our human rights complaints. We did raise these issues in the UN Human Rights Commission, and the U.S. had to answer. And of course, it's very difficult to say that a Supreme Court decision doesn't exist. So they did. They had to admit, yes, our law does provide that the federal government can take Indian land without due process. And they just said, well, but we don't do it much. You know, it was that kind of thing. I think that's extremely healthy. I mean, we need to answer back now that, oh, yes, you do. How about ANCSA? You know, there's a nice example. But of course, I can't say that. I mean, it would have to be, if anybody's going to say something like that, it should be Alaska Native people. I need to stop giving such long answers, but it's part of an overall strategy. It tends to develop political, international, moral support, and that's always essential when you're trying to build a movement, when you're trying to make change. And we get a lot more understanding, frankly, elsewhere than we do in U.S. official circles. And I don't mean, there are people out there who would like to manipulate these questions and use them for purely political purposes to embarrass the United States. Now you have to watch that. You know, you don't want to get too involved with that kind of silly politics, but that is not the name of the game. And pressing these issues as human rights issues can be very important. I mean, let's face it, the law of the United States is racially discriminatory. A certain race of people is denied basic rights that everyone else has. Now that's just bareface in violation of basic international human rights law. And we can take advantage of that to say, well, let's change it. The United States should change its law and deal more fairly with Native peoples. And once again, this is the best case going. I mean, by a long shot, by 100 or 1,000 times, this is the best and strongest case there is to dramatize that issue.
ANCSA
is.
Well, can we turn back to one of the best cases going, the David case? And David, could I ask you, just before we get...
Deny the characterization.
I see. Well, Tim disagreed